2010. Pete Sauber's parents had lots of arguments now. Tina called them the Arky Barkies. Pete thought she had something there because that was what they sounded like when they got going. Ark, 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 bark, bark, bark. Sometimes Pete wanted to go to the head of the stairs and scream down at them to quit it. Just quit it. "You're scaring the kids," he wanted to yell. "There are kids in this house. Kids. Did you two stoops forget that?" Pete was home because honor roll students with nothing but afternoon study hall and activity period after lunch were allowed to cut out early. His door was open, and he heard his father go thumping rapidly across the kitchen on his crutches as soon as his mother's car pulled into the driveway. Pete was pretty sure today's festivities would start with his dad saying, "Gosh, she was home early." Mom would say he could never seem to remember that Wednesdays were now her early days. Dad would reply that he still wasn't used to living in this part of the city, saying it like they'd been forced to relocate into deepest, darkest Lowtown instead of just the Tree Street section of Northfield. Once the preliminaries were taken care of, they could get down to the real arcing and barking. Pete wasn't crazy about the North Side himself, but it wasn't terrible. And even at 13, he seemed to understand the economic realities of their situation better than his father. Maybe because he wasn't swallowing OxyContin pills 4 times a day like his father. They were here because Grace Johnson Middle School, where his mother used to teach, had been closed as part of the city council's cost-cutting initiative. Many of the GJ teachers were now unemployed. Linda, at least, had been hired as a combination librarian and study hall monitor at Northfield Elementary. She got out early on Wednesdays because the library closed at noon that day. All the school libraries did. It was another cost-cutting initiative. Pete's dad railed at this, pointing out that the council members hadn't cut their salaries and calling them a bunch of goddamn Tea Party hypocrites. Pete didn't know about that. What he knew was that these days Tom Sauber's railed at everything. The Ford Focus, their only car now, pulled up in the driveway and Mom slid out, dragging her old scuffed briefcase. She skirted the patch of ice that always formed in the shady spot under the front porch downspout. It had been Tina's turn to salt that down, but she had forgotten as usual. Mom climbed the steps slowly, her shoulders low. Pete hated to see her walk that way, as if she had a sack of bricks on her back. Dad's crutches, meanwhile, thumped a double-time rhythm into the living room. The front door opened. Pete waited, hoped for something nice like, "Hiya, honey, how was your morning?" As if. He didn't exactly want to eavesdrop on the Arky Barkies, but the house was small and it was practically impossible not to overhear, unless he left, that is, a strategic retreat he made more and more frequently this winter. And he sometimes felt that, as the older kid, he had a responsibility to listen. Mr. Jacoby liked to say in history class that knowledge was power, and Pete supposed that was why he felt compelled to monitor his parents' escalating war of words. Because each Arky Barky stretched the fabric of the marriage thinner, and one of these days it would tear wide open. Best to be prepared. Only prepared for what? Divorce? That seemed the most likely outcome. In some ways, things might be better if they did split up. Pete felt this more and more strongly, although he had not yet articulated it as a conscious thought. But what exactly would a divorce mean in another of Mr. Jacoby's faves, real-world terms? Who would stay and who would go? If his dad went, how would he get along without a car when he could hardly walk? For that matter, how could either of them afford to go? They were broke already. At least Tina wasn't here for today's spirited exchange of parental views. She was still in school and probably wouldn't be home directly after, maybe not until dinner. She had finally made a friend, a buck-toothed girl named Ellen Briggs, who lived on the corner of Sycamore and Elm. Pete thought Ellen had the brains of a hamster, but at least Tina wasn't always moping around the house, missing her friends in the old neighborhood, and sometimes crying. Pete hated it when Tina cried. Meanwhile, silence your cell phones and turn off your pagers, folks. The lights are going down, And this afternoon's installment of We're in Deep Shit is about to begin. Tom.
Hey, you're home early.
Linda. Wearily.
Tom, it's...
Tom. Wednesday, right. Early day at the library.
Linda. You've been smoking in the house again. I can smell it.
Tom. Getting his sulk on. Just one in the kitchen with the window open. There's ice on the back steps and I didn't want to risk a tumble. Pete forgot to salt them again.
Pete. Aside to the audience. As he should know, since he made the schedule of chores, it's actually Tina's week to salt. Those Oxycontins he takes aren't just pain pills, they're stupid pills.
Linda.
I can still smell it, and you know the lease specifically prohibits...
Tom.
All right, okay, I get it. Next time I'll go outside and risk falling off my crutches.
Linda.
It's not just the lease, Tommy. The secondary smoke is bad for the kids. We've discussed that.
Tom.
And discussed it and discussed it.
Linda. Now wading into even deeper water.
Also, how much does a pack of cigarettes cost these days? $4.50? $5?
Tom.
I smoke a pack a week, for Christ's sake.
Linda. Overrunning his defenses with an arithmetic panzer assault.
At $5 a pack, that's over $20 a month, and it all comes out of my salary, because it's the only one.
Tom.
Oh, here we go.
Linda, we've got now.
Tom.
You never get tired of rubbing that in, do you? Probably think I got run over on purpose so I could laze around the house.
Linda, after a long pause.
Is there any wine left? Because I could use half a glass.
Pete. Aside.
Say there is, Dad. Say there is.
Tom.
It's gone. Maybe you'd like me to crutch my way down to the Zonies and get another bottle. Of course, you'd have to give me an advance on my allowance.
Linda. Not crying, but sounding on the verge.
You act as though what happened to you is my fault.
Tom. Shouting.
It's nobody's fault, and that's what drives me crazy. Don't you get that? They never even caught the guy who did it.
At this point, Pete decided he'd had enough. It was a stupid play. Maybe they didn't see that, but he did. He closed his lit book.
He would read the assigned story, something by a guy named John Rothstein, that night. Right now, he had to get out and breathe some uncontentious air.
Linda.
Quiet. At least you didn't die.
Tom. Going totally soap opera now.
Sometimes I think it would be better if I had. Look at me, hooked through the bag on Oxy, and still in pain because it doesn't work for shit anymore unless I take enough to have kill me, living on my wife's salary, which is 1,000 less than it used to be thanks to the fucking tea partiers.
Linda, watch your length.
Tom, house? Gone. Motorized wheelchair? Gone. Savings? Almost used up. And now I can't even have a fucking cigarette.
Linda. If you think whining will solve anything, be my guest, but...
Tom, roaring. Is whining what you call it? I call it reality. You want me to drop my pants so you can get a good look at what's left of my legs?
Pete floated downstairs in his stocking feet. The living room was right there at the bottom, but they didn't see him. They were face to face and busy acting in a dipshit play no one would ever pay to see. His father hulking on his crutches, his eyes red and his cheeks scruffy with beard. His mother holding her purse in front of her breasts like a shield and biting her lips. It was awful. And the worst part? He loved them. His father had neglected to mention the emergency fund, started a month after the city center massacre by the town's one remaining newspaper, in cooperation with the three local TV stations. Brian Williams had even done a story about it on NBC Nightly News. How this tough little city took care of its own when disaster struck. All those caring hearts, all those helping hands, all that blah, blah, blah. And now a word from our sponsor. The emergency fund made everybody feel good for like 6 days. What the media didn't talk about was how little the fund had actually raised, even with the charity walks and the charity bike rides and a concert by an American Idol runner-up. The emergency fund was thin because times were hard for everyone. And of course, what was raised had to be divided among so many. The Saubers family got a check for $1,200, then one for $500, then one for $2. Last month's check, marked final installment, came to $50. Big whoop. Pete slipped into the kitchen, grabbed his boots and jacket, and went out. The first thing he noticed was that there wasn't any ice on the back stoop. His father had been totally lying about that. The day was too warm for ice, at least in the sun. Spring was still 6 weeks away, but the current thaw had gone on for almost a week, and the only snow left in the backyard was a few crusty patches under the trees. Pete crossed to the fence and let himself out through the gate. One advantage to living in the tree streets of the north side was the undeveloped land behind Sycamore. It was easily as big as a city block, 5 tangled acres of undergrowth and scrubby trees running downhill to a frozen stream. Pete's dad said the land had been that way for a long time and was apt to stay that way even longer, due to some endless legal wrangle over who owned it and what could be built on it. In the end, no one wins these things but the lawyers, he told Pete. Remember that. In Pete's opinion, kids who wanted a little mental health vacation from their parents also won. A path ran through the winter-barren trees on a meandering diagonal, eventually coming out at the Birch Street Rec, a longtime Northfield youth center whose days were now numbered. Big kids hung out on and around the path in warm weather, smoking cigarettes, smoking dope, drinking beer, probably laying their girlfriends, but not at this time of year. No big kids equaled no hassle. Sometimes Pete took his sister along the path if his mother and father were seriously into it, as was more and more often the case. When they arrived at the rec, they'd shoot baskets or watch videos or play checkers. He didn't know where he could take her once the rec closed. There was no place else except for Zoni's, the convenience store. On his own, he mostly just went as far as the creek, splooshing stones into it if it was flowing, bouncing them off the ice when it was frozen, seeing if he could make a hole and enjoying the quiet. The Arky Barkies were bad enough, but his worst fear was that his dad, now always a little high on the oxy pills, might someday actually take a swing at his mother. That would almost certainly tear the thin stretched cloth of the marriage. And if it didn't, if she put up with being hit, that would be even worse. Never happen, Pete told himself. Dad never would. But if he did? Ice still covered the stream this afternoon, but it looked rotten, and there were big yellow patches in it as if some giant had stopped to take a leak. Pete wouldn't dare walk on it. He wouldn't drown or anything if the ice gave way. The water was only ankle deep, but he had no wish to get home and have to explain why his pants and socks were wet. He sat on a fallen log, tossed a few stones. The small ones bounced and rolled, the big ones went through the yellow patches, then just looked at the sky for a while. Big fluffy clouds floated along up there, the kind that looked more like spring than winter, moving from west to east. There was one that looked like an old woman with a hump on her back, or maybe it was a pack sack. There was a rabbit, there was a dragon, there was one that looked like a soft crumbling thump on his left distracted him. He turned and saw an overhanging piece of the embankment, loosened by a week's worth of melting snow, had given way, exposing the roots of a tree that was already leaning precariously. The space created by the fall looked like a cave, and unless he was mistaken, he supposed it might be just a shadow. There was something in there. Pete walked to the tree, grabbed one of its leafless branches and bent for a better look. There was something there, all right, and it looked pretty big. The end of a box, maybe? He worked his way down the bank, creating makeshift steps by digging the heels of his boots into the muddy earth. Once he was below the sight of the little landspill, he squatted. He saw cracked black leather and metal strips with rivets in them. There was a handle the size of a saddle stirrup on the end. It was a trunk. Someone had buried a trunk here. Excited now as well as curious, Pete grabbed the handle and yanked. The trunk didn't budge. It was socked in good and tight. Pete gave another tug, but just for form's sake. He wasn't going to get it out, not without tools. He hunkered with his hands dangling between his thighs as his father often used to do before his hunkering days came to an end, just staring at the trunk jutting out of the black, root-snarled earth. It was probably crazy to be thinking of Treasure Island, also the Gold Bug, a story they'd read in English the year before, but he was thinking of it. And was it crazy? Was it really? As well as telling them that knowledge was power, Mr. Jacoby stressed the importance of logical thinking. Wasn't it logical to think that someone wouldn't bury a trunk in the woods unless there was something valuable inside? It had been there for a while, too. You could tell just looking at it. The leather was cracked and gray in places instead of black. Pete had an idea that if he pulled on the handle with all his might and kept pulling, it might break. The metal binding strips were dull and lacy with rust. He came to a decision and pelted back up the path to the house. He let himself in through the gate, went to the kitchen door, listened. There were no voices, and the TV was off. His father had probably gone into the bedroom, the one on the first floor. Mom and Dad had to sleep there, even though it was small because Dad couldn't climb stairs very well now, to take a nap. Mom might have gone in with him. They sometimes made up that way, but more likely she was in the laundry room that doubled as her study, working on her resume and applying for jobs online. His dad might have given up, and Pete had to admit he had his reasons, but his mom hadn't. She wanted to go back to teaching full-time and not just for the money. There was a little detached garage, but his mom never put the Focus in it unless there was going to be a snowstorm. It was full of stuff from the old house that they had no room for in the smaller rented place. His dad's toolbox was in there. Tom had listed the tools on Craigslist or something, but hadn't been able to get what he considered a fair price for them. And some of Tina's and his old toys, and the tub of salt with its scoop, and a few lawn and garden implements leaning against the back wall. Pete selected a spade and ran back down the path, holding it in front of him like a soldier with his rifle at high port. He eased his way almost all the way down to the stream, using the steps he'd made, and went to work on the little landslide that had revealed the trunk. He shoveled as much of the fallen earth as he could back into the hole under the tree. He wasn't able to fill it all the way to the gnarled roots, but he was able to cover the end of the trunk, which was all he wanted. For now. There was some arcing and barking at dinner, not too much, and Tina didn't seem to mind, but she came into Pete's room just as he was finishing his homework. She was wearing her footy pajamas and dragging Mrs. Beasley, her last and most important comfort doll. It was as if she had returned to the age of 5. "Can I get in your bed for a while, Petey? I had a bad dream." He considered making her go back, then decided, thoughts of the buried trunk flickering in his mind, that to do so might be bad luck. It would also be mean, considering the dark hollows under her pretty eyes. "Yeah, okay, for a while, but we're not going to make a practice of it." One of their mom's favorite phrases. Tina scooted across the bed until she was against the wall, her sleeping position of choice, as if she planned to spend the night. Pete closed his earth science book, sat down beside her, and winced. "Doll warning, teens. Mrs. Beasley's head is halfway up my butt." "I'll scrunch her down by my feet. There, is that better?" "What if she smothers?" "She doesn't breathe, stupid. She's just a doll, and Ellen says pretty soon I'll get tired of her." "Ellen's a doofus." "She's my friend." Pete realized with some amusement that this wasn't exactly disagreeing. "But she's probably right. People grow up." "Not you. You'll always be my little sister. And don't go to sleep. You're going back to your room in like 5 minutes."
10.
6. She considered.
"Okay."
From downstairs came a muffled groan, followed by the thump of crutches. Pete tracked the sound into the kitchen where Dad would sit down, light a cigarette, and blow the smoke out the back door. This would cause the furnace to run, and what the furnace burned, according to their mother, was not oil but dollar bills.
"Are they going to get divorced, do you think?"
Pete was doubly shocked, first by the question, then by the adult matter-of-factness of it. He started to say, "No, of course not." Then thought how much he disliked movies where adults lied to children, which was like all movies. I don't know. Not tonight, anyway. The courts are closed. She giggled. That was probably good. He waited for her to say something else. She didn't. Pete's thoughts turned to the trunk buried in the embankment beneath that tree. He had managed to keep those thoughts at arm's length while he did his homework, but... No, I didn't. Those thoughts were there all the time. Teens, you better not go to sleep.
I'm not.
But damn close from the sound. What would you do if you found a treasure? A buried treasure chest full of jewels and gold doubloons.
What are doubloons?
Coins from olden days.
I'd give it to Daddy and Mommy, so they wouldn't fight anymore. Wouldn't you?
Yes, Pete said. Now go back to your own bed before I have to carry you. Under his insurance plan, Tom Sauber's only qualified for therapy twice a week now. A special van came for him every Monday and Friday at 9 o'clock and brought him back at 4 in the afternoon after hydrotherapy and a meeting where people with long-term injuries and chronic pain sat around in a circle and talked about their problems, all of which meant that the house was empty for 7 hours on those days. On Thursday night, Pete went to bed complaining of a sore throat. The next morning, he woke up saying it was still sore, and now he thought he had a fever, too. You're hot, all right, Linda said after putting the inside of her wrist to his brow. Pete certainly hoped so after holding his face 2 inches from his bedside lamp before going downstairs. If you're not better tomorrow, you probably should see the doctor. Good idea, Tom exclaimed from his side of the table where he was pushing around some scrambled eggs. He looked like he hadn't slept at all. A specialist, maybe. Just let me call Shorty the chauffeur. Tina's got dibs on the rolls for her tennis lesson at the country club, but I think the town car is available. Tina giggled. Linda gave Tom a hard look, but before she could respond, Pete said he didn't feel all that bad. A day at home would probably fix him up. If that didn't, the weekend would.
I suppose, she sighed.
Do you want something to eat? Pete did, but thought it unwise to say so since he was supposed to have a sore throat. He cupped his hand in front of his mouth and created a cough. Maybe just some juice. Then I guess I'll go upstairs and try to get some more sleep. Tina left the house first, bopping down to the corner where she and Ellen would discuss whatever weirdo stuff 9-year-olds discussed while waiting for the school bus. Then Mom for her school and the focus. Last of all, Dad, who made his way down the walk on his crutches to the waiting van. Pete watched him go from his bedroom window, thinking that his father seemed smaller now. The hair sticking out around his groundhog's cap had started to turn gray. When the van was gone, Pete threw on some clothes, grabbed one of the reusable grocery shopping bags Mom kept in the pantry, and went out to the garage. From his father's toolbox, he selected a hammer and chisel, which he dumped into the bag. He grabbed the spade, started out, then came back and took the crowbar as well. He had never been a Boy Scout, but believed in being prepared. The morning was cold enough for him to see his breath, but by the time Pete dug enough of the trunk free to feel he had a chance of pulling it out, the air had warmed up to well above freezing and he was sweating under his coat. He draped it over a low branch and peered around to make sure he was still alone here by the stream. He had done this several times. Reassured, he got some dirt and rubbed his palms with it, like a batter getting ready to hit. He grasped the handle at the end of the trunk, reminding himself to be ready if it broke. The last thing he wanted to do was tumble down the embankment ass over teapot. If he fell into the stream, he really might get sick. Probably nothing in there but a bunch of moldy old clothes anyway. Except why would anyone bury a trunk filled with old clothes? Why not just burn them or take them to the Goodwill? Only one way to find out. Pete took a deep breath, locked it down in his chest, and pulled. The trunk stayed put, and the old handle creaked warningly, but Pete was encouraged. He found he could now shift the trunk from side to side a little. This made him think of Dad tying a thread around one of Tina's baby teeth and giving a brisk yank when it wouldn't come out on its own. He dropped to his knees, reminding himself he would do well to either wash these jeans later on or bury them deep in his closet, and peered into the hole. He saw a root had closed around the rear of the trunk like a grasping arm. He grabbed the spade, choked up on the handle, and chopped at it. The root was thick, and he had to rest several times, but finally he cut all the way through. He laid the spade aside and grabbed the handle again. The trunk was looser now, almost ready to come out. He glanced at his watch. 10:15. He thought of Mom calling home on her break to see how he was doing. Not a big problem. When he didn't answer, she'd just think he was sleeping. But he reminded himself to check the answering machine when he got back. He grabbed the spade and began to dig around the trunk, loosening the dirt and cutting a few smaller roots. Then he took hold of the handle again. "This time, you mother," he told it. "This time for sure." He pulled. The trunk slid forward so suddenly and easily that he would have fallen over if his feet hadn't been braced far apart. Now it was leaning out of the hole, its top covered with sprays and clods of dirt. He could see the latches on the front, old-fashioned ones, like the latches on a workman's lunchbox. Also a big lock. He grabbed the handle again, and this time it snapped. "Fuck-a-duck," Pete said, looking at his hands. They were red and throbbing. "Well, in for a penny, in for a pound," another of his mom's favorite sayings. He gripped the sides of the trunk in a clumsy bear hug and rocked back on his heels. This time it came all the way out of its hidey hole and into the sunlight for the first time in what had to be years. A damp and dirty relic with rusty fittings. It looked to be 2.5 feet long and at least 1.5 feet deep, maybe more. Pete hefted the end and guessed it might weigh as much as 60 pounds, half his own weight, but it was impossible to tell how much of that was the contents and how much the trunk itself. In any case, it wasn't doubloons. If the trunk had been filled with gold, he wouldn't have been able to pull it out at all, let alone lift it. He snapped the latches up, creating little showers of dirt, and then bent close to the lock, prepared to bust it off with the hammer and chisel. Then, if it still wouldn't open, and it probably wouldn't, he'd use the crowbar. But first, he never knew until he tried. He grasped the lid, and it came up in a squall of dirty hinges. Later, he would surmise that someone had bought this trunk secondhand, probably getting a good deal because the key was lost, but for now he only stared. He was unaware of the blister on one palm, or the ache in his back and thighs, or the sweat trickling down his dirt-streaked face. He wasn't thinking of his mother, his father, or his sister. He wasn't thinking of the Arky Barkies either, at least not then. The trunk had been lined with clear plastic to protect against moisture. Beneath it, he could see piles of what looked like notebooks. He used the side of his palm as a windshield wiper and cleared a crescent of fine droplets from the plastic. They were notebooks, all right. Nice ones, with what almost had to be real leather covers. It looked like 100 at least. But that wasn't all. There were also envelopes, like the ones his mom brought home when she cashed a check. Pete pulled away the plastic and stared into the half-filled trunk. The envelopes had Granite State Bank and Your Hometown Friend printed on them. Later, he would notice certain differences between these envelopes and the ones his mom got at Corn Bank and Trust. No email address and nothing about using your ATM card for withdrawals, but for now, he only stared. His heart was beating so hard, he saw black dots pulsing in front of his eyes, and he wondered if he was going to faint. "Bullshit, you are. Only girls do that." Maybe, but he felt decidedly woozy and realized part of the problem was that since opening the trunk, he had forgotten to breathe. He inhaled deeply, whooshed it out, and inhaled again. All the way down to his toes, it felt like. His head cleared, but his heart was whamming harder than ever and his hands were shaking. "Those bank envelopes will be empty. You know that, don't you? People find buried money in books and movies, but not in real life." Only they didn't look empty. They looked stuffed. Pete started to reach for one, then gasped when he heard rustling on the other side of the stream. He whirled around and saw two squirrels there, probably thinking the week-long thaw meant spring had arrived, making merry in the dead leaves. They raced up a tree, tails twitching. Pete turned back to the trunk and grabbed one of the bank envelopes. The flap wasn't sealed. He flipped it up with a finger that felt numb, even though the temperature now had to be riding right around 40. He squeezed the envelope open and looked inside. Money. 20s and 50s.
Holy Jesus God Christ in heaven, Pete Salbers whispered.
He pulled out the sheaf of bills and tried to count, but at first his hands were shaking too badly and he dropped some. They fluttered in the grass, and before he scrambled them up, his overheated brain assured him that Ulysses Grant had actually winked at him from one of the bills. He counted. $400. 400 in this one envelope, and there were dozens of them. He stuffed the bills back into the envelope. Not an easy job, because now his hands were shaking worse than Grandpa Fred's in the last year or two of his life. He flipped the envelope into the trunk and looked around, eyes wide and bulging. Traffic sounds that had always seemed faint and far and unimportant in this overgrown stretch of ground now sounded close and threatening. This was not Treasure Island. This was a city of over 1 million people, many now out of work, and they would love to have what was in this trunk.
Think, Pete Salbers told himself. Think, for God's sake.
This is the most important thing that's ever happened to you. Maybe the most important thing that ever will happen to you. So think hard and think right. What came to mind first was Tina, snuggled up next to the wall in his bed. What would you do if you found a treasure? He had asked. Give it to Daddy and Mommy, she had replied. But suppose Mom wanted to give it back? It was an important question. Dad never would, Pete knew that, but Mom was different. She had strong ideas about what was right and what wasn't. If he showed them this trunk and what was inside it, it might lead to the worst arky-barky about money ever.
Besides, give it back to who? Pete whispered. The bank?
That was ridiculous. Or was it? Suppose the money really was pirate treasure, only from bank robbers instead of buccaneers. But then why was it in envelopes, like for withdrawals? And what about all those black notebooks? He could consider such things later, but not now. What he had to do now was act. He looked at his watch and saw it was already 10:45. He still had time, but he had to use it.
Use it or lose it,
he whispered, and began tossing the Granite State Bank cash envelopes into the cloth grocery bag that held the hammer and chisel. He placed the bag on top of the embankment and covered it with his jacket. He crammed the plastic wrap back into the trunk, closed the lid, and muscled the trunk back into the hole. He paused to wipe his forehead, which was greasy with dirt and sweat, then seized the spade and began to shovel like a maniac. He got the trunk covered, mostly, then seized the bag and his jacket and ran back along the path toward home. He would hide the bag in the back of his closet, that would do to start with, and see if there was a message from his mother on the answering machine. If everything was okay on the mom front, and if Dad hadn't come home early from therapy, that would be horrible, he could whip back to the stream and do a better job of concealing the trunk. Later, he might check out the notebooks, but as he made his way home on that sunny February morning, his only thought about them was that there might be more money envelopes mixed in with them, or lying beneath them. He thought, I'll have to take a shower and clean the dirt out of the bathtub after so she doesn't ask what I was doing outside when I was supposed to be sick. I have to be really careful, and I can't tell anyone. No one at all. In the shower, he had an idea. 1978. Home is the place that when you go there, they have to take you in. But when Morris arrived at the house on Sycamore Street, there were no lights to brighten the evening gloom and no one to welcome him at the door. Why would there be? His mother was in New Jersey, lecturing about how a bunch of 19th-century businessmen had tried to steal America, lecturing grad students who would probably go on to steal everything they could lay their hands on as they chased the golden buck. Some people would undoubtedly say that Morris had chased a few golden bucks of his own in New Hampshire, but that wasn't so. He hadn't gone there for money. He wanted the Biscayne in the garage and out of sight. Hell, he wanted the Biscayne gone, but that would have to wait. His first priority was Pauline Muller. Most of the people on Sycamore Street were so wedded to their televisions once prime time started that they wouldn't have noticed a UFO if one landed on their lawn. But that wasn't true of Mrs. Muller. The Bellamy's next-door neighbor had raised snooping to a fine art, so he went there first.
"Why, look who it is!"
she cried when she opened the door, just as if she hadn't been peering out her kitchen window when Morris pulled into the driveway.
"Maury Bellamy, big as life and twice as handsome."
Morris produced his best aw-shucks smile. "How you doing, Mrs. Muller?" She gave him a hug, which Morris could have done without, but dutifully returned. Then she turned her head, setting her wattles in motion, and yelled,
"Bert! Bertie! It's Maury Bellamy!"
From the living room came a triple grunt that might have been, "How you doing?"
"Come in, Maury, come in. I'll put on coffee. And guess what?"
She gave her unnaturally black eyebrows a horrifyingly flirtatious wiggle.
"There's Sara Lee Poundcake."
"Sounds delicious, but I just got back from Boston. Drove straight through. I'm pretty beat. Just didn't want you to see lights next door and call the police."
She gave a monkey shriek of laughter. "You're so thoughtful." "But you always were. How's your mom, Maury?"
"Fine." He had no idea. Since his stint in reform school at 17 and his failure to make a go of City College at 21, relations between Morris and Anita Bellamy amounted to the occasional telephone call. These were frosty but civil. After one final argument the night of his arrest for breaking and entering and assorted other goodies, they had basically given up on each other.
"You've really put on some muscle," Mrs. Muller said. "The girls must love that. You used to be such a scrawny thing."
"Been building houses."
"Building houses? You! Holy gosh! Bertie, Morris has been building houses!"
This produced a few more grunts from the living room. "But then the work dried up, so I came back here. Mom said I was welcome to use the place unless she managed to rent it, but I probably won't stay long." How right that turned out to be.
"Come in the living room, Maury, and say hello to Bert."
"I better take a rain check." To forestall further importuning, he called, "Yo, Bert!" Another grunt, unintelligible over the laugh track accompanying, "Welcome back, Cotter."
"Tomorrow, then,"
Mrs. Muller said, her eyebrows once more waggling. She looked like she was doing a Groucho imitation.
"I'll save the pound cake. I might even whip some cream."
"Great," Morris said. It wasn't likely Mrs. Muller would die of a heart attack before tomorrow, but it was possible. As another great poet said, "Hope springs eternal in the human breast." The keys to house and garage were where they'd always been, hanging under the eave to the right of the stoop. Morris garaged the Biscayne and set the trunk from the antiques barn on the concrete. He itched to get at that fourth Jimmy Gold novel right away. But the notebooks were all jumbled up, and besides, his eyes would cross before he read a single page of Rothstein's tiny handwriting. He really was bushed. "Tomorrow," he promised himself. "After I talk to Andy, get some idea of how he wants to handle this, I'll put them in order and start reading." He pushed the trunk under his father's old work table and covered it with a swatch of plastic he found in the corner. Then he went inside and toured the old homestead. It looked pretty much the same, which was lousy. There was nothing in the fridge except a jar of pickles and a box of baking soda, but there were a few Hungry Man dinners in the freezer. He stuck one in the oven, turned the dial to 350, then climbed the stairs to his old bedroom. "I did it," he thought. "I made it. I'm sitting on 18 years' worth of unpublished John Rothstein manuscripts." He was too tired to feel exultation or even much pleasure. He almost fell asleep in the shower and again over some really crappy meatloaf and instant potatoes. He shoveled it in, though,
then trudged back up the stairs. He was asleep 40 seconds after his head hit the pillow and didn't wake up until 9:20 the following morning. Well rested, and with a bar of sunlight pouring across his childhood bed, Morris did feel exultation, and he couldn't wait to share it, which meant Andy Halliday. He found khakis and a nice Madras shirt in his closet, slicked back his hair, and peeked briefly into the garage to make sure all was well there. He gave Mrs. Muller, once more looking out through the curtains, what he hoped was a jaunty wave as he headed down the street to the bus stop. He arrived downtown just before 10, walked a block, and peered down Ellis Avenue to the Happy Cup, where the outside tables sat under pink umbrellas. Sure enough, Andy was on his coffee break. Better yet, his back was turned, so Morris could approach undetected. "Booga booga," he cried, grabbing the shoulder of Andy's old corduroy sport coat. His old friend, really his only friend in this benighted joke of a city, jumped and wheeled around. His coffee overturned and spilled. Morris stepped back. He had meant to startle Andy, but not that much.
"Hey, sorry."
"What did you do?" Andy asked in a low, grinding whisper. His eyes were blazing behind his glasses. Horn rims Morris had always thought of as sort of an affectation. "What the fuck did you do?" This was not the welcome Morris had anticipated. He sat down. "What we talked about." He studied Andy's face and saw none of the amused intellectual superiority his friend usually affected. Andy looked scared. Of Morris? Maybe. For himself? Almost certainly. "I shouldn't be seen with you." Morris was carrying a brown paper bag he'd grabbed from the kitchen. From it he took one of Rothstein's notebooks and put it on the table, being careful to avoid the puddle of spilled coffee. "A sample. One of a great many. At least 150. I haven't had a chance to do a count yet, but it's the total jackpot."
"Put that away!"
Andy was still whispering like a character in a bad spy movie. His eyes shifted from side to side, always returning to the notebook.
"Rothstein's murder is on the front page of the New York Times and all over the TV, you idiot!"
This news came as a shock. It was supposed to be at least 3 days before anyone found the writer's body, maybe as long as 6. Andy's reaction was even more of a shock. He looked like a cornered rat. Morris flashed what he hoped was a fair approximation of Andy's "I'm so smart, I bore myself" smile. "Calm down. In this part of town, there are kids carrying notebooks everywhere." He pointed across the street toward Government Square. "There goes one now."
"Not moleskins, though. Jesus! The housekeeper knew the kind Rothstein used to write in, and the paper says the safe in his bedroom was open and empty. Put it away!"
Morrie pushed it toward Andy instead, still being careful to avoid the coffee stain. He was growing increasingly irritated with Andy. PO'd, as Jimmy Gold would have said, but he also felt a perverse sort of pleasure at watching the man cringe in his seat, as if the notebook were a vial filled with plague germs. "Go on, have a look. This one's mostly poetry. I was paging through it on the bus."
"On the bus? Are you insane?"
"And it's not very good," Morris went on as if he hadn't heard. "But it's his, all right. A holograph manuscript. Extremely valuable. We talked about that. Several times. We talked about how..."
"Put it away!"
Morris didn't like to admit that Andy's paranoia was catching, but it sort of was. He returned the notebook to the bag and looked at his old friend, his one friend, sulkily. "It's not like I was suggesting we have a sidewalk sale or anything."
"Where are the rest?"
And before Morris could answer,
"Never mind. I don't want to know. Don't you understand how hot those things are? How hot you are?"
"I'm not hot," Morris said. But he was, at least in the physical sense. All at once his cheeks and the nape of his neck were burning. Andy was acting as if he'd shit his pants instead of pulling off the crime of the century. "No one can connect me to Rothstein. And I know it'll be a while before we can sell them to a private collector. I'm not stupid."
"Sell them to a Morrie, do you hear yourself?"
Morris crossed his arms and stared at his friend, the man who used to be his friend at least.
You act as if we never talked about this, as if we never planned it.
We didn't plan anything. It was a story we were telling ourselves. I thought you understood that.
What Morris understood was Andy Halliday would tell the police exactly that if he, Morris, were caught. And Andy expected him to be caught.
For the first time, Morris realized consciously that Andy was no intellectual giant eager to join him in an existential act of outlawry, but just another nebbish. A bookstore clerk, only a few years older than Morris himself.
Don't give me your dumbass literary criticism, Rothstein had said to Morris in the last 2 minutes of his life. You're a common thief, my friend.
His temples began to throb. I should have known better. All your big talk about private collectors, movie stars, and Saudi princes, and I don't know who all. Just a lot of big talk. You're nothing but a blowhard. That was a hit. A palpable hit. Morris saw it and was glad, just as he had been when he had managed to stick it to his mother once or twice in their final argument. Andy leaned forward, cheeks flushed, but before he could speak, a waitress appeared with a wad of napkins. Let me get that spill, she said, and wiped it up. She was young, a natural ash blonde, pretty in a pale way, maybe even beautiful. She smiled at Andy. He returned a pained grimace, at the same time drawing away from her as he had from the moleskin notebook. He's a homo, Morris thought wonderingly. He's a goddamn homo. How come I didn't know that? How come I never saw? He might as well be wearing a sign. Well, there were a lot of things about Andy he'd never seen, weren't there? Morris thought of something one of the guys on the housing job liked to say. All pistol and no bullets. With the waitress gone, taking her toxic atmosphere of girl with her, Andy leaned forward again. Those collectors are out there, he said. They pile up paintings, sculpture, first editions. There's an oil man in Texas who's got a collection of early wax cylinder recordings worth $1 million, and another one who's got a complete run of every Western, science fiction, and Shudder pulp magazine published between 1910 and 1955. Do you think all of that stuff was legitimately bought and sold? The fuck it was. Collectors are insane. The worst of them don't care if the things they covet were stolen or not, and they most assuredly do not want to share with the rest of the world. Morris had heard this screed before, and his face must have shown it, because Andy leaned even farther forward. Now their noses were almost touching. Morris could smell English leather and wondered if that was the preferred aftershave of homos, like a secret sign or something. But do you think any of those guys would listen to me? Morris Bellamy, who was now seeing Andy Halliday with new eyes, said he guessed not. Andy pooched out his lower lip. They will someday, though. Yeah, once I get my own shop and build up a clientele. But that'll take years. We talked about waiting 5. 5? Andy barked a laugh and drew back to his side of the table again. I might be able to open my shop in 5 years. I've got my eye on a little place in Lacemaker Lane. There's a fabric store there now, but it doesn't do much business. But it takes longer than that to find big money clients and establish trust. Lots of buts, Morris thought, but there were no buts before. How long? Why don't you try me on those notebooks around the turn of the 21st century if you still have them? Even if I did have a call list of private collectors right now, today, not even the nuttiest of them would touch anything so hot. Morris stared at him, at first unable to speak. At last he said, You never said anything like that when we were planning. And he clapped his hands to the sides of his head and clutched it. We planned nothing! And don't you try to lay this off on me. Don't you ever! I know you, Maury. You didn't steal them to sell them. At least not until you've read them. Then I suppose you might be willing to give some of them to the world if the price was right. Basically, though, you're just batshit crazy on the subject of John Rothstein. Don't call me that,
His temples were throbbing worse than ever.
I will if it's the truth, and it is. You're batshit crazy on the subject of Jimmy Gold, too. He's why you went to jail.
I went to jail because of my mother. She might as well have locked me up herself.
Whatever.
It's water under the bridge. This is now. Unless you're lucky, the police are going to be paying you a visit very soon, and they'll probably arrive with a search warrant. If you have those notebooks, when they knock on your door, your goose will be cooked.
Why would they come to me? Nobody saw us. And my partners.
He winked.
Let's just say that dead men tell no tales.
You... what? Killed them? Killed them too?
Andy's face was a picture of dawning horror.
Morris knew he shouldn't have said that, but funny how that but kept coming around. Andy was just being such an asshole.
What's the name of the town that Rothstein lived in?
Andy's eyes were shifting around again as if he expected the cops to be closing in even now, guns drawn.
Talbot Corners, right?
Yes, but it's mostly farms. What they call the Corners is nothing but a diner, a grocery store, and a gas station where two state roads cross.
How many times were you there?
Maybe five. It had actually been closer to a dozen between 1976 and 1978. Alone at first, then with either Freddie or Curtis or both.
Ever ask questions about the town's most famous resident while you were there?
Sure, once or twice. So what? Probably everybody who ever stops at that diner asks about...
No, that's where you are wrong. Most out-of-towners don't give a shit about John Rothstein. If they've got questions, it's about when deer season starts. Or what kind of fish they could catch in the local lake. You don't think the locals will remember you when the police ask if there have been any strangers curious about the guy who wrote The Runner? Curious strangers who made repeat visits? Plus you have a record, Maury!
Juvenile, it's sealed.
Something as big as this the seal might not hold.
And what about your partners? Did either of them have records?
Morris said nothing.
You don't know who saw you, and you don't know who your partners might have bragged to about the big robbery they were going to pull off. The police could nail you today, you idiot!
If they do, and you bring my name up, I'll deny we ever talked about this, but I'll give you some advice. Get rid of that.
He was pointing to the brown paper bag. That. And all the rest of the notebooks. Hide them somewhere. Bury them. If you do that, maybe you can talk your way out of it if push comes to shove. Always supposing you didn't leave fingerprints or something.
We didn't, Morris thought. I wasn't stupid. And I'm not a cowardly, big-talking homo either.
Maybe we can revisit this, Andy said, but it will be much later on. And only if they don't grab you.
He got up. In the meantime, stay clear of me, or I'll call the police myself.
He walked away fast, with his head down, not looking back.
Morris sat there. The pretty waitress returned to ask if she could get him anything. Morris shook his head. When she left, he picked up the bag with a notebook inside it and walked away himself. In the opposite direction. He knew what the pathetic fallacy was, of course, nature echoing the feelings of human beings, and understood it to be the cheap, mood-creating trick of second-rate writers, but that day it seemed to be true. The morning's bright sunlight had both mirrored and amplified his feeling of exultation, but by noon the sun was only a dim circle behind a blear of clouds. And by 3 o'clock that afternoon, as his worries multiplied, the day grew dark and it began to drizzle. He drove the Biscayne out to the mall near the airport, constantly watching for police cars. When one came roaring up behind him on Airline Boulevard with its blues flashing, his stomach froze and his heart seemed to climb all the way into his mouth. When it sped by without slowing, he felt no relief.
He found a news broadcast on BAM 100. The lead story was about a peace conference between Sadat and Begin at Camp David. Yeah, like that'll ever happen, Morris thought distractedly. But the second one concerned the murder of noted American writer John Rothstein. People were saying it was the work of a gang of thieves and that a number of leads were being followed. That was probably just PR bullshit. Or maybe not. Morris didn't think he could be tracked down as a result of interviews with the half-dead old codgers who hung out at the yummy diner in Talbot Corners, no matter what Andy thought. But there was something else that troubled him far more. He, Freddie, and Curtis had all worked for Donahue Construction, which was building homes in both Danvers and North Beverly. There were two different work crews, and for most of Morris's 16 months, spent carrying boards and nailing studs, he had been in Danvers while Curtis and Freddie toiled at the other site, 5 miles away. Yet for a while, they had worked on the same crew, and even after they were split up, they usually managed to eat lunch together. Plenty of people knew this. He parked the Biscayne with about 1,000 others at the J.C. Penney end of the mall, wiped down every surface he had touched, and left the keys in the ignition. He walked away fast, turning up his collar and yanking down his Indian's cap. At the mall's main entrance, he waited on a bench until a Northfield bus came and dropped his 50 cents into the box. The rain grew heavier and the ride back was slow, but he didn't mind. It gave him time to think. Andy was cowardly and full of himself, but he had been right about one thing. Morris had to hide the notebooks, and he had to do so immediately, no matter how much he wanted to read them, starting with that undiscovered Jimmy Gold novel. If the cops did come and he didn't have the notebooks, they could do nothing. Right? All they'd have would be suspicion. Right? There was no one peeking through the curtains next door, which saved him another conversation with Mrs. Muller, and perhaps having to explain that he had sold his car. The rain had become a downpour, and that was good. There would be no one rambling around in the undeveloped land between Sycamore and Birch, especially after dark. He pulled everything out of the second-hand trunk, resisting an almost overpowering urge to look into the notebooks. He couldn't do that, no matter how much he wanted to, because once he started, he wouldn't be able to stop. Later, he thought. Must postpone your gratifications, Maury. Good advice. But spoken in his mother's voice, and that started his head throbbing again. At least he wouldn't have to postpone his gratifications for long. If 3 weeks went by with no visits from the police, a month at most, he would be able to relax and begin his researches. He lined the trunk with plastic to make sure the contents would stay dry, and put the notebooks, including the one he'd taken to show Andy, back inside. He dumped the money envelopes on top. He closed the trunk, considered, and opened it again. He pawed the plastic aside and took a couple of $100 from one of the bank envelopes. Surely no cop would think that an excessive amount, even if he were searched. He could tell them it was his severance pay or something. The sound of the rain on the garage roof was not soothing. To Morris, it sounded like skeletal tapping fingers and made his headache worse. He froze every time a car went by, waiting for headlights and pulsing blue strobes to splash up the driveway. Fuck Andy Halliday for putting all these pointless worries in my head, he thought. Fuck him and the homo horse he rode in on. Only the worries might not be pointless. As afternoon wound down toward twilight, the idea that the cops could put Curtis and Freddie together with Morris Bellamy seemed more and more likely. That fucking rest area. Why hadn't he dragged the bodies into the woods, at least? Not that it would have slowed the cops down much once someone pulled in, saw all the blood, and called 911. The cops would have dogs. Besides, he told the trunk, I was in a hurry, wasn't I? His father's hand dolly was still standing in the corner along with a rusty pick and two rusty shovels. Morris tipped the trunk endwise onto the dolly, secured the straps and peered out of the garage window. Still too much light. Now that he was so close to getting rid of the notebooks and the money,
temporarily, he soothed himself. This is just a temporary measure. He became more and more sure that the cops would be here soon. Suppose Mrs. Muller had reported him as acting suspicious. It didn't seem likely. She was thicker than an oak plank, but who really knew? He forced himself to stuff down another frozen dinner, thinking it might soothe his head. It made the headache worse instead. He looked in his mother's medicine cabinet for aspirin or Advil and found nothing. Fuck you, Mom, he thought. Really, sincerely, fuck you. He saw her smile, thin as a hook, that smile. It was still light at 7 o'clock. Goddamn daylight saving time, what genius thought that up? But the windows next door were still dark. That was good, but Morris knew the Mullers might be back at any time. Besides, he was too nervous to wait any longer. He rooted around in the front hall closet until he found a poncho. He used the garage's rear door and yanked the dolly across the back lawn. The grass was wet, the ground underneath spongy, and it was hard going. The path he had used so many times as a kid, usually going to the Birch Street wreck, was sheltered by overhanging trees, and he was able to make better progress. By the time he got to the little stream that flowed diagonally across this block-sized square of waste ground, full dark had arrived. He had brought a flashlight and used it in brief winks to pick out a likely location on the embankment of the stream, a safe distance from the path. The dirt was soft, and it was easy digging until he got to the tangle of roots from an overhanging tree. He thought about trying a different spot, but the hole was almost big enough for the trunk already, and he was damned if he was going to start all over again, especially when this was just a temporary precaution. He laid the flashlight in the hole, propping it on a rock so the beam shone on the roots, and chopped through them with the pick. He slid the trunk into the hole and shoveled the dirt back around it and over it quickly. He finished by tamping it down with the flat of the shovel. He thought it would be okay. The bank wasn't particularly grassy, so the bald spot wouldn't stand out. The important thing was that it was out of the house, right? Right? He felt no relief as he dragged the dolly back along the path. Nothing was working out the way it was supposed to, nothing. It was as if malignant fate had come between him and the notebooks, just as fate had come between Romeo and Juliet. That comparison seemed both ludicrous and perfectly apt. He was a lover. Goddamn Rothstein had jilted him with the runner slows down, but that didn't change the fact. His love was true.